I'm Nell Frizzell, and this is The Panic Years. When I was 28, everyone around me seemed to be getting married, getting promotions, buying houses, and having babies. I was single, redundant, and living with my mum. At the time, I thought it was a private crisis. Now I understand it was just my panic years, and that is what this podcast is all about. I'm on a little island, surrounded by a rather green river. There are some horses on the other side and some allotments just over the way, but also some burnt beer cans and bottle tops at my feet. This is one of my regular swimming spots, and while it is beautiful, it's also where horny 13-year-olds come to destroy their brain cells. Oh, hello, geese. There they go. My little fanfare. I order them every time I'm going to go for a swim. This week I've cut my hair, did it myself, why not? Actually did it between two Zoom calls, which caused quite a weird continuity situation for the people who were attending both. I call it a square cut. I did it with some scissors and two mirrors in the old-fashioned way. My guest this week is the comedian, actor, writer and all-round beautiful man, Rob Delaney. When I first saw Catastrophe, which he co-wrote and starred in with Sharon Horgan, it gave me genuine hope while in the pit of my panic years for the future. He's so funny and kind and generous. I met him years ago backstage, actually, at a comedy gig, and we both bonded over the fact that we weren't drinking. I also knew from his stand-up that Rob had had quite an interesting set of panic years himself, including a career change, long-distance relationship, quite a serious car incident, and reckoning with his fertility. So it was my pleasure to talk to Rob all about fatherhood, falling in love, his vigorous stretching regime, and whether men and women's sex drives are really as mismatched as we're led to believe. Please stick around after the interview, because I'll be talking in a little bit more detail to the superb expert guest, Dr. Kate Lister, the woman behind Whores of Yore, and you won't want to miss it. All right, geese, bloody hell. How are you, and how is your body?
Oh, that's such a great question. My body's okay. I've just served myself some ice cream. I use ice cream the way like a dad in the 1950s would have used beer to unwind from the day. I don't drink or do drugs. I haven't for a very long time, but I still need to fix with something. And so that's often ice cream.
Sure.
My body generally feels pretty good. I've started exercising every day, rather than just like 3 days a week. So I run just about every day. And that's really
amazing.
Important, but not just for like good reasons. I mean, it's really helps with like psychological, emotional maintenance. So I find it really necessary. So my body feels, you know, pretty good.
Am I right in thinking that quite a lot of your psychological function inhabits your thighs?
Oh, yeah. I have. That's funny you should say that, because I had a costume fitting today for a new TV show that I'm going to do. And it was the first costume fitting, and they had me trying on all these trousers. And I'm like, oh, I forgot to tell them I don't have normal thighs and buttocks. And nothing fit. It almost felt like I was like being discriminated against for having a big ass and thighs.
I think not big. I think we call it high functioning. High functioning thighs.
I'll take it.
I was desperate to talk to you because you're a very thoughtful, kind man.
Oh, thanks.
You're also one of those people who I think offers an insight into the lives of men and women that I don't get very often, which is sort of kind and thoughtful, but also very droll.
Well,
I want to talk to you because basically your show Catastrophe, when it came out, gave me solace. Here were two people who were in a state of sort of last roll of the dice in terms of their fertility, romantically, in terms of their, I don't know, the future decisions. What made you want to write about that? How did you tap into that? That was a thing, that this almost last roll of the dice thing happened to men and women, but it looked quite different to both of them.
Well, my immediate answer is I don't know. I didn't personally think of it as a last roll of the dice, although I did think one sort of asset that Sharon Horgan and I had as a writing team was that we were maybe a little bit older than your average whippersnapper. And as such, we were tired. We had lost battles in our lives. And I thought that was a good point to start for a loving relationship, because it didn't have necessarily a glorious beginning. And it was sort of like muscular and purposeful and like workmanlike from the beginning. And it really, they were called upon to make a decision about their relationship really early on. And I thought that was good, I feel like a fertile place to start from.
Well, you say fertile. I think that's a great word, because you are clearly an incredibly fertile man. But did you ever worry about it? Did you ever think in your 20s, was having children, being a dad, your fertility, something on your radar to think about?
Yeah, I was. And in fact, when I was in my early 20s, mid-20s, I found a lump on one of my testicles, and I went through the process of finding out if it was testicular cancer. It wasn't. And when they analyzed my semen and found out that I had what looked to be like functioning sperm and I didn't have testicular cancer, I remember crying because, you know, I had a little scare thinking, well, what if I can't get a woman pregnant? And I didn't allow myself really, I guess, to think about it until I found out that I could, you know, while I was scared. And then when I found out that I could, it was such a relief, you know?
Wow, that's amazing. Having a like fertility MOT is something that I would have loved to have had in my 20s. If someone had just said, either way, you can or you can't, or you're this likely to, I don't know if it would have necessarily calmed down my sense of panic. The fact that it's so mysterious, until you actually either get someone pregnant or try to get someone pregnant, you have no idea whether that's ever going to happen. Did you know you wanted to be a dad, though?
Yeah, I did. Not like a constant thought.
Yeah,
but
and had you held babies before you had babies?
Oh, yeah, I was crazy about them. Loved them. Yeah, for sure.
Did you ever feel like an outlier in that? Or did you feel like you were sort of going against the grain to be a man who clearly enjoyed being in the proximity and showing affection for babies? Did it come naturally to you?
I'd say it came naturally. You know, there was nature and then there was nurture involved. Like I saw my dad loved babies, and I was fortunate to have uncles who were thrilled about their kids. And then my wife was a teacher for, you know, we were together 6 years or so, 6-7 years before we had kids. And we met as camp counselors. So I was not remarkable in my sphere with my love for babies.
I don't know if it came to America, but here there was a famous poster of like a topless man holding a baby. And it was like the wank fantasy for all women of the sort of mid-90s and beyond. But it's also a funny thing where you have to be a topless, extremely muscular male model for that to not seem, I don't know. I don't know what it is, like soft somehow to be cuddly and broody, but you won't ever hear them talk about it.
I mean, I had a vasectomy a little less than a year ago. And the reason I did was because my wife had been pregnant 4 times in, you know, pretty fairly close together. And that was wonderful. But, you know, it's so vastly much more is demanded of women when they have a baby than the man who changes, you know, the diapers and all that. So the reason that I got a vasectomy was because we didn't want her to get pregnant again. Not that we didn't want to have more babies, just we didn't want her to go through more pregnancies, and so that she could you know, spread her wings and devote some more time to just herself, you know, which is made very difficult when you have a lot of kids. But anyway, so I've had a vasectomy, so I ostensibly cannot sire children anymore. And I often am like a little sad about it. You know, I'll see a baby because like my youngest is almost 2.5. So in his own words now, he's a big boy. So I hate that I'm not going to make any more babies. It sucks. But it doesn't suck as much as the good of why I decided to do it. You know what I mean?
Honestly, this is like listening to the sort of heavenly music of a host of harp-playing angels for me, because to men saying, yes, I get really broody, and also men saying, yes, I will take on the burden of contraception myself. Two things that I just long to hear more of in the public sphere.
Yeah, I'm a big vasectomy advocate. I mean, if there was a way that didn't involve a little surgery on your balls, I would explore it. But you know, we're not there yet. But just as a little commercial for vasectomies, I've had no side effects like at all. So
you don't ejaculate powder.
Nope. And yeah, it's still a horrible mess. And it's, you know, libido, same performance, same, which is to say, you know, mediocre / sub-mediocre. not garbage, but kind of like, meh.
It's so lovely to hear that, because also if your sense of your manliness is so caught up with one particular tube in your body, it's fragile, isn't it? If that's what makes you feel like a man.
Okay. One, yes. Two, I still totally felt that way.
There'll be no
use in my, you know, like, I guess I'll have sex sometimes, you know, but surely I'll never want to masturbate again. And I still do both types of sex, which just all by my lonesome and then sometimes with my bride.
I definitely noticed that men in their 20s had this like vision that they were not going to land and settle and take on responsibilities until a friendy Wendy with a nightgown and a sewing needle were going to make them. And I wonder where that came from. Like, I can't imagine that my granddad, who was like a mustachioed horse vet, was running around in his 20s thinking, no one's going to tie me down. But then also, I don't think that makes men happy.
No, it doesn't. And I think, honestly, it's maybe part of a narrative that we see in capitalist culture where it's really great for, you know, big multinational corporations and governments and stuff, if half the population is angry at the other half, you know, divide and conquer. So they do a great job, you know, through advertising and media to set, for example, half of voters against the other half of voters, you know, and then they do the same thing with men and women. We actually have to look at, you know, how are we being played? And then they think they have to live up to it.
Yeah, and if you're sold a particular version of happiness, then you can spend an enormous amount of money trying to reach it, because it is actually incredibly unfulfilling. Casual sex in designer clothes, in Instagram-worthy holiday venues, are quite satisfying up to a point, and then they are deeply rotting to your soul. But you will spend a huge amount of money on the way getting those things.
Oh, sure, yeah. And I think even on an individual level, they try to do that. You know, they try to have people be at war within themselves. You know, I've got to have this thing. I've got to, shame on me if I don't have that, if I don't do that, if I'm not perceived to be doing this or that. A lot of conflict.
My panic years, as I'm calling them, sort of kicked in at about 28. I now realize I came out of a long-term relationship and I was made redundant. Some of my friends were getting married and some of them were even having children. And I remember thinking, like, 28 is an insane year. And I know there was a kind of cultural norm that 27 was when rock stars died. And I felt like I was the person who had not died at 27, but was basically exploding my life at 28. What were you doing at 28?
Well, at 28, I was dating my wife, cross country. She lived in D.C., Washington, D.C., and I lived in L.A., which stands for Los Angeles. We dated cross country for a year, which is so ridiculous.
Wow.
Because even as I was first falling for her when I met her in Massachusetts, like a place where neither of us lived, you know, we met and I started to fall for her and I was like, well, this is ridiculous. I need to nip this in the bud. I need to cauterize these feelings out of me because it's irresponsible and ridiculous to date someone long distance. That's for crazy people who are afraid of commitment or of something else wrong with them, because there's someone in Los Angeles I could date and there's someone in DC that she could date and I'm sure we could be perfectly happy. So this is just plain silly, but I couldn't not. I truly was crazy about her. And so, yeah, every 3 weeks, one of us would fly on Alaska Airlines because they had like the cheapest direct flight.
Okay. Flown by Sarah Palin.
DC.
Each way.
Yeah. Yeah. She's the pilot. And sometimes her daughter Willow or son Track would be her co-pilot. Like British people are like, I don't know or care what you're talking about. Anyway, but it was wild. So I guess that was quite a romantic year.
Yeah. And a life-changing. Did you think this is a life-changing person? This is a life-changing year.
I was aware that I had never fallen so hard or so fast for someone before. I was cognizant of it.
Wow.
You know, I was also working. I had a corporate job at an advertising company that I hated, but I had to do it because in America, this is before President Obama created the Affordable Care Act, which meant that anyone could buy health insurance. Before that, you could really only get it from your job. So I had a job that I hated, a woman that I was wildly in love with. It was a wild time.
At what age did you decide to throw off the shackles of corporate life and move in together and do all that? Because that, to me, feels like that is the step where you say, you know, on one hand, I'm going to, in an interpersonal way, settle down, but in a personal way, I'm going to go wild. I'm going to like throw all security to the wind.
So believe it or not, that was at the age of 30 that I got laid off from my third corporate job that provided health insurance in a row. And I was like, you know what? I want to make people laugh full time. I'm going to pursue it. And so the good news is, and I was just telling a very young friend earlier today how I had a bit of luck that as soon as I made that decision, the global financial crisis happened in 2008. And why that was good is because then everybody started losing their job, even people who thought that they had a career that was solid. So at that time, I was like, wait a minute, being an artist is literally not any crazier than any other job that you would think could have longevity. So that was very...
Wow, what an interesting way.
Yeah, it was really instructive for me. And it made me realize, like, if you have a crazy dream or a so-called crazy dream, a dream that you've told been told is crazy, it isn't. You know, nothing is certain in this world. And, you know, somebody's got to be writing books and somebody's got to be making jokes on TV. Why not you?
Is that something that you'd already been doing? You were already making people laugh for money.
Yeah, I was giving it away for free at that point. I did get a Bachelor of Fine Arts in musical theater at uni. That's what I studied in school. And then I did start to have some success upon graduation doing theater, musicals, soap operas and stuff. And then I was like, wow, I think this might be getting going somewhere.
I once had the pure pleasure of watching you do a series of stretches after a run that I presume you learned when you were doing musical theatre. And it was like a beautiful piece of choreography. The whole body was getting nimble, limber.
Well, you're very kind, if that's a nice thing. Maybe you're saying you're horrified.
Genuinely, it was really lovely. It was like a sort of one-man dance piece.
I studied jazz, tap, and ballet for like 3 hours, 3 days a week, all throughout uni. So I did kind of get addicted to stretching. And now since I'm so huge, I mean, I'm a big person, and I run a lot, I've kind of gotten used to stretching. So if I don't do like a full complement of dancer stretches after a run, I get very uncomfortable. So yeah, I am a weird, flexible, gigantic man.
Beautiful.
Not particularly strong, not particularly fast, but flexible, sure.
Bendy. Amazing. So yeah, you already were performing, and so the move to comedy wouldn't be quite so frightening.
But gotta say, I remember I was 30 when I left that corporate job. So I graduated at age 22. So there's 8 years in between. So I have like a couple years of work as an actor, but then because of my drinking, I'm in a car accident at age 25. And so that took me out of commission from performing for a few years as I dealt with jail, court dates, surgeries, getting and staying sober. So I kind of got shunted into the corporate world because I needed health insurance.
For a lot of comedians, that is three Edinburgh shows you've just listed off there. Right. Jail, car accident. I've got my next 3 years lined up. I absolutely don't mean to belittle your terrible time.
Please belittle away.
I'll just belittle it a little further. I always remember reading that Debbie Harry, she had her first single was released when she was 30, when Blondie had their first single, and thinking, at the time I was about like 25, thinking, surely not, like, that's too late. No one can be successful after 25. But it's really heartening to think that actually you hadn't necessarily got too far up the ladder or along the path that you were going on.
Yeah, no, I didn't first pay my rent strictly through writing and comedy until I was 33, I think.
When I was 28 and I'd been made redundant and I'd broken up with my partner, I basically thought I was having a personal crisis. I thought this was an entirely self-made cock-up and that I had sort of gone off the rails. When you were having a change in career, did you see that as part of a bigger picture and a longer process, or did you just think that you were having a one-man crisis?
Maybe a little of both, you know, because, like, I mean, I still really believe that 30 is young. You know, ideally, that's, you know, there'll be plenty more chapters and stuff in your life. But I did think, if this is what I want to do for a living, then it's time to really say thank you for this opportunity of being laid off a third time in less than 3 years and go for it. You know what I mean? So it's like a little bit of a rug got pulled out from under me and I said, thank you, rug, I think is what happened.
Yeah, I think that's quite right. I think to be an early adopter of unemployment in a global financial crash is a very cool move. I graduated into that financial crash. Okay. I had sort of thought I would work in newspapers, mm-hmm. and everyone was like, oh, print, oh no.
We don't have that anymore.
Yeah, we're not going to do that anymore. And I was like, okay. So what is the plan work-wise? But then, like you say, the plan work-wise is only as good as the while it's happening. There's no point in having a big plan work-wise because all sorts of things are going to hit you.
You have to do what you want. It's not crazy to chase a dream.
Is this a song? Is this from your musical theatre days?
I was about to break into song.
At what point did you start thinking that you might have babies? Or was it not a thinking thing? Did it just happen?
So, yeah, we got married in 2006, and then we had our first son when I was 34. Yeah, around there.
You said a lovely thing to me when I was pregnant. I said, basically, what the hell is coming? What can I expect? Help.
Yeah.
And I said, particularly for my partner, like, what does he do at this stage? And you said, if you are the partner of someone giving birth, you are the vice president of comfort.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think being there, watching someone give birth to your baby, did that change you? What did it mean for you?
You know, it's funny because I was describing my oldest son's birth to him just yesterday or the day before.
Nice.
Yeah, they love to hear about it. And I was talking to him, and I remember when his head started to exit my wife's body, I was like, I didn't understand what it was. I mean, I'd watched all the videos, I'd read all the books, but I was like, what is exiting my wife's vagina? This can't be, like, I literally thought there must be something inside a woman's body that looks like a little head. And then that comes out, and then maybe it slides open like a sliding door, and then the baby comes out. Like,
sure.
I just couldn't believe it. It was such a miracle. And then just seeing something so, you know, primordial just take over, watching that happen was very, very special. And I'm glad I got to see it four times.
I always wonder if it's quite scary thing to be the birth partner, because you have like no one really has a huge amount of control, but you are also in a weird way quite, for lack of a better word, impotent, that you can't make it better.
you really can't. I'll say for our fourth son who was born, he was born at home and in the very room that I'm talking to you from right now.
And you haven't cleaned. It's really quite gross.
Yeah, I just slipped in some old placenta. He was born. And I remember when the midwife got here, I think two midwives came. And then they asked if an EMT could watch just to, like, learn what was going on. And since it was my wife's fourth baby, she was like, yeah, come on in. And we had a... We had a neighbor here. Both our older boys were here. But I remember saying to the midwife, I was like, here are the rules. You can ask me any question that you need the answer to, anything you need help with or need to know or something is, ask me anything. You can tell my wife what to do, give her direction, tell her what you need to do, but you may not ask her any questions. That's forbidden. I receive the questions. She can receive orders or guidance, but do not ask her any questions. And
what a brilliant point.
Yeah, my wife later was like, thank you for that.
It is wild. I had a friend recently who had to, it looked like she was going to have an emergency cesarean. And so she was having to sign all these forms and answer all these things. And she was just like, I'm sorry, I don't really know where my body is right now.
Yeah, that's insane.
But do you rate home births? Do you think they're the way?
If you want to and you can, yeah. I will say my wife's favorite birth experience was her water birth at home. And she had two in hospitals in Los Angeles and then one in a hospital in London. That was a water birth. And then a water birth at home. And the water birth at home was her favorite by a fair amount.
Would you do it if you could? Like, if you...
Yeah, definitely.
Really?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Breastfeeding, the whole shebang.
All that. Yeah. If I ever got reincarnated as a human and wasn't a woman, I'd be super pissed. Yeah. I mean, just see what it's like, you know?
When you were growing up, what was expected of you by your parents or your teachers or your friends? What were you sort of expected to achieve?
I mean, I think pretty standard fare. It was expected that I would go to university, I would say. I don't think they necessarily cared what I did, but I think it was, you know, more roads will be open to you if you have a college degree. I remember I was told from a young age that I would go to the local Catholic boys high school, but that rolled around and I was like, absolutely not. And my parents were like, okay, you know, but it was like a couple generations ahead of me and the family had gone to this boys Catholic high school and they were like, you should go here too. And I didn't want to. And then they really did not put up a fight. They were like, fine, you can go to the normal high school that has girls that's even closer. And it all worked.
Did you feel rebellious? Did you feel sort of like you were pushing?
Not terribly, because they were like, even as I explained it to them, they were like, I don't quite remember the exact conversation, but my parents being like, huh, so the kid wants to go to school that has girls, huh? And what is he, 14? Yeah, I guess that all checks out, you know?
Actually, this leads on perfectly to something that I am really interested in. I've basically started to believe that there is quite a huge global conspiracy, mm-hmm. which tells us that men have a higher libido than women. Mm-hmm. Cis men have a higher libido than cis women. Mm-hmm. And something happened, and it's sort of, you know, it starts in adolescence, where there's this idea that all adolescent boys are just absolutely desperate to get their hands on anyone. But then, whoa, my God, you hit your 30s. And mm-hmm. I've never known a libido like the libido of a 30-year-old woman. But the cultural myth remains that mm-hmm. men want to keep having as much sex as they can, maybe with as many people as they can. Mm-hmm. And women are very monomaniacal. They want to have one person and then mm-hmm. their libido drops off. Were you brought up to think that you were like going to be horny forever? Is it conspiracy is what I'm saying?
No. In my experience, that's a conspiracy. First, I'll say I just finished today the book Never Let Me Go by Ishiguro. I've never read it before. And it's narrated by one woman from her teenage years, maybe adolescence at the earliest, up until, you know, middle age or so. She talks about being ashamed of her horniness. And there's one character who kind of uses that against her in the book. And then later in the book, she kind of learns like, oh, I was taken advantage of, not sexually, but taken advantage of in a way right. that somebody made me feel guilty about what I wanted to do with my young, beautiful, healthy body. And it's just really sensitively written about in the book in a really great way. And like, so that's ridiculous. I mean, women get horny, men get horny. I mean, what's funny is that like a thing that happens when you're in a long-term relationship is like my wife and I will get horny at different times. So it's not necessarily that one is more, but like my wife might want to have sex and I'll be like, are you kidding me? It's 10:15 in the nighttime. That's 15 minutes past bedtime. That's pretty much psychopath territory.
I'm so with you.
Yeah. And so, but then I'll be like, you know, it'll be like 11:15 in the morning and like the kids will be upstairs and I'll be like, hey, she'll be like, that's impossible. It is impossible to imagine having sex with you at this moment.
Well, I'm very glad to hear it is a conspiracy. All these things, basically, you're myth-busting. Long-term relationships are a disaster. You have to get settled down to a good job in your 30s. You have to be tied down to a basically frigid woman in your 40s. None of it is... What you're saying is none of it's true.
Thank you, Rob, for such a lovely chat. As you can hear, I have some pretty strong feelings about the old libido question, and so decided to go digging into our cultural history to find out more about where this idea came from. Step forward the hilarious and brilliant Dr. Kate Lister, lecturer, author, TEDx speaker, and One Woman Archive of Filth. Kate also curates an excellent online research project, Whores of Yore. I kicked off by asking Kate, when did we start claiming that one gender had a higher sex drive than the other?
Where has that come from? This idea that women, quote unquote, have a lower libido than men. Where did that come from?
Oh, it's horseshit. So there's a long history of this, but the idea that women have low libidos or no libidos or are weird if they have a libido largely comes to us from our good friends, the Victorians. So it's long as it goes back to the 19th century. But before that, if you look in sort of the medieval history, it was actually believed that women were hugely sexually voracious and that women were far more lusty and uncontrollable than men. were, and that they needed men to control them and to basically keep them in check. And men were the more stoic, in control ones. If you look at sort of like your medieval preachers like Saint Jerome, they've got this idea that women are just unbelievably horny. They're full of sin. They're full of lust. They're the ones that need to be controlled. And then by the time you get to the 19th century, you've got this new narrative creeping in, and it was largely propagated by the medical profession, not all of them at all, but that's largely where it's coming from.
Hashtag not all Victorian medics.
Hashtag not all Victorian medics. We won't throw them all under the bus. But there were like guys like Dr. William Acton, who said that women aren't troubled with sexual desire of any kind. And he was writing in sort of like the mid-19th century. And that's where this idea starts to come from. And that stayed with us. We're still living under the restraints of that, aren't we? We still have this idea that sex somehow belongs to men, and a really horny woman is like a sexual fantasy or an aberration.
Something you wrote that I love about how chastity belts are like the great bit of Victorian propaganda about medieval sexuality.
The Victorians are endlessly fascinating. They've got people like Dr. William Acton going, nope, they're definitely not horny. They're definitely not. And then you've got rivers of Victorian pornography. They're very, very horny in that. So you've got loads and loads of mixed messages. But the Victorians did a real hatchet job on medieval history. And any medieval scholars get very, very upset. They still haven't gotten over it. They're very angry with them. But it's the Victorians who told us all this stuff about chastity belts and swooning damsels locked in towers and charging knights and all of this stuff. And it really says more about the Victorians than it does about the medieval period. But that's where our modern stereotypes about the medieval period come from. The Victorians, who were desperate to kind of present it as this like sort of fairy tale land of charging knights and quests and all that kind of stuff. But no, they weren't like that at all, the Middle Ages. Of course they weren't.
One thing that the Middle Ages did come a cropper with, and that we, I think this is in the historical context something I wanted to unpick with you, is that sex as an act of pleasure or self-exploration or emotional expression, separate to reproduction and the sort of baby-making possibility of bodies. Where do we get our historical understanding of that? Because I know it must have happened. Like, people were making plugs out of horse hair and spinach or whatever they used as kind of those. I don't know, what did they? But like, people were having sex without wanting to have babies, presumably forever?
Forever. It's one of the things that we're not very good at. We struggle to think of people in the past, historical people, having sex, which when you actually stop and you think about it, it's, well, of course they did. We're the living, walking proof that they did. But we're even less good at realising that they had kinky sex, that they enjoyed sex, that they masturbated, had same-sex sex, did naughty, dirty, perverted things. Every generation thinks that they've invented sex for the first time. Of course people were having kinky, naughty sex. Sex can be a lot of fun, so of course people were doing that. And, you know, they've excavated what are listed as devotional objects, but could well be sex toys, that are over 36,000 years old.
Wow.
You know, in really ancient frescoes of Pompeii and Greece, there's images of cunnilingus, anal sex, group sex, all kinds of things. The reasons why we have sex are very, very varied.
I mean, cunnilingus and anal sex, one of their many benefits is that you're not going to get pregnant, I suppose. Who writes about sex as a pleasure as opposed to sex as a way to have babies?
I mean, loads and loads of different people have written about this over the years, but I suppose the really influential authority is probably the church, as the church gets going, the medieval church. And it's because the church is caught in this bind of saying that sex is sinful, but also you have to go forth and multiply. And there ain't no multiplying without the sexy bit, right? So they're in this real bind, the medieval church, of like, right, so it's sinful, but you've got to do it. So that's when they start coming up with all these kind of strange rules around it. Like, okay, well, how are we going to do this? And then medieval theologians and early church founders, they start coming up with stuff like, you can have sex, but you can't enjoy it. It's basically like that. And they've got things like, you can't have sex on feast days, you can't have sex on holy days, you can't have sex in anything but the missionary position, you can't have sex in the daytime, you can't have sex with anybody but your wife, you can't have sex with anyone but with your wife unless she's menstruated. And it goes on and on and on. And when you actually look at them, there's probably about 4 days of the year that anyone can actually have sex without going straight to hell. So normal people weren't following this stuff. Well, I mean, maybe they were giving it their best shot. But it's really the church that starts to come down with this idea of like sex for reproduction, that's good and holy as long as you don't enjoy it. But anything other than that, that's very, very bad.
I actually can't have sex on a feast day just because I get very farty. But that
you just get very gassy. Yeah. That's exactly it, which is exactly what the early church fathers were all about.
They were really worried about flatulent, wanton women ruining the air.
Yeah, that's it. That's really big with the early founders.
I also think, and I've fallen into this trap here as well, that we talk about women and sex or female sexuality, women having sex. And what I mean is middle class women. The kind of way that we talked about female sexuality was really separate to the way we talked about working class female sexuality. Like female pleasure was sort of denied or it was ignored or it was, you know, it was made to seem sinful. There was always the kind of assumption, not to put it too baldly, that working class women were up for it and like middle class women were a bit frigid. Do you think that's a fair classification or is that just an ill-informed my version of events?
You've got to remember that the class system has been much, much more rigid than it is now. And to a certain extent, your upper classes have been constrained and liberated as well in ways that poorer women weren't. For example, if you're a woman in the 19th century and if you happen to have a bit of cash around you and you come from money, you are expected to behave a certain way because you've got the money and the privilege to do it. You're expected to marry. You're expected to kind of be a good housewife, Jane Austen type of stuff, dutiful, stay at home and all that stuff. But if you're a poor woman, well, you can't afford to be doing this nonsense. You need to earn money. You can't be saying to people, look, I can't go out to work because I just have to be ladylike. I'm going to sit here and sew. You can't do that. So there are different freedoms that are allocated depending on how much money and power and privilege that you've got. Absolutely. And there has been this idea throughout a lot of history that working class women, poverty, kind of sexual promiscuity went hand in hand. And we still kind of do that. That kind of classism is still there. You can see it in something like the media furore about young mothers or single mothers. Yeah. And it's very class based, that. So we absolutely do that. But I think that it would be unfair to say that middle class women were also viewed as completely frigid. They just had greater expectations on them, I think. And of course, it depends what time period we're talking at and who we're talking to. For example, if you look at the 19th century, yeah, women were supposed to behave themselves and stay at home and just generally walk around going, I don't fancy anyone, I'm not horny at all, and be like these angels in the house. But then if you look at Victorian erotica, a lot of that is based in stately homes with, you know, lady such and such, and they're absolutely ripping the knickers off one another. So again, it depends who you're talking to.
Talking of who you're talking to or who is talking to you, I wondered, Who were the women, and they probably cisgendered women here we're talking about, who were talking about sexual pleasure in the way back? Like who were the good people to read or look at?
Do you know, this is the thing when you're studying the history of sex, is you're trying to, what you've kind of identified there is almost like the Holy Grail, because it's so hard to get hold of are the first hand accounts of the everyday people. If you want to find out what priests or the church or moralists or lawmakers or doctors or whoever thought about sex, you can find stuff, but you can't, trying to actually find just the everyday account makes it much more difficult. And that can skew the data, because if you look at people like our friend Dr. William Atkins, who's wandering around going, yeah, women don't fancy anyone at all, you could be mistaken for thinking everyone in the 19th century thought that. But whether or not, how much influence that had, whether he said that and Victorian women went, jog on, we just don't know.
Yeah. To go back to my initial question, this idea that men have a stronger libido than women, cisgendered men, cisgendered women, where did that come from? Like who can we blame?
I'd love to be able to give you an answer that it was like George Smith on a Tuesday but it doesn't really work like that. You've got a kind of like a shift in a sense of masculinity and femininity in about the 19th century. And as women are being defined as sort of very passive angels in the house, and they're very, even more associated with childbearing and being good, you know, like, and that what kind of arises in counteraction to that is that, well, if women are sexless, then men must be the kind of the highly sexed ones.
Do you think it goes in that order? Because I joked about it being a conspiracy theory. Like, there is a massive national gaslighting that men have a higher libido than women.
Oh, well, that's definitely true.
Done to shore up the sort of frailty of the male ego, that no one wants to admit that they are, from the age of about 20 onwards, massively outstripped by the, like, galloping libido of every cisgendered woman around
I think that that's definitely true, but I don't think it's like an organized conspiracy, you know, like it's the Illuminati or something. I don't think it was. Horny men aren't that organized. They couldn't pull that off. But it's a shift in attitude. And then by the time you get to like sort of the 20th century, it's very ingrained, this idea that women are sexually frigid or don't have a stronger sex drive. But all throughout history, we've been far more accepting of men sowing their wild oats than women, even in the time period when we thought that women were massively sexually voracious. We still gave much more freedom to men. You know, there are anthropologists who work on that very question of, like, why is female sexuality shamed and male sexuality isn't in that way? And there's a number of competing theories, one of them being that it's to do with patrilineal inheritance rights.
Yeah.
So the idea is that as soon as you've got capital and money and something to inherit, it suddenly becomes of significance who your child belongs to. Is this your child? And if wealth passes from father down to son, it's suddenly very important to know who your missus has been shagging.
Hence the fetishization of marrying a virgin.
Boom.
You have a sort of guaranteed bloodline.
Absolutely. Yeah. In the West, in particular, female sexuality has come in for a lot of censor. And there are pockets of matrilineal societies around the world. One thing they all have in common is that inheritance passes from the mother's line. So there is some evidence to that. I'd love to tell you that it was this massive conspiracy that happened on a Tuesday, but it wasn't. It was a slow shift of attitudes. And then by the time we've got to the 20th century, I think male sexuality and male prowess, they are very much tied together with this idea of sexual conquest. And, like, you know, lads, whoop, whoop. And it's very much tied to how many people can you shag. And that starts becoming more and more entrenched. And as the guys are becoming rutting stags and isn't that great, the women are supposed to be, I wouldn't want to do that, how naughty, that kind of thing. But it is complete nonsense, isn't it?
The maths of it alone makes it nonsense. Like, that unless all those men are having sex with one incredibly busy woman, there has to be an equal number of sexually available and sexually enthusiastic partners. If all men had like three or four sexual partners before they got married, who were they?
They were, well, it's hard to say. It depends, again, who you're talking to. Sex workers have always been demonised and stereotyped and also, like, promiscuous, quote-unquote promiscuous women are often lumped into this category along with sex workers, who are kind of demonised as being the thing that men want, but they're also the things that they're most afraid of, so we're going to really stigmatise them and say horrible things.
Yeah, we're going to commodify them, marginalise them and stigmatise them.
And it's interesting as well that the space of the sex work, despite all the stigma and all the abuses that can happen, has throughout history provided a route to wealth and power that nothing else can do.
Yeah. I mean,
that's interesting, right? Is that the sex industry, you know, however you want to judge that, you can't deny the fact that that was one route throughout history that allowed women enormous power over men, and no other profession did.
I used to have the King Charles quote about "Don't let poor Nelly starve" as his dying words.
Yes.
I used to think that.
There you go.
As someone called Nell, who had a fair amount of casual sex, I always wanted that to be like, look, I don't want your time and I don't necessarily want your love, but just buy me breakfast.
Buy me breakfast. Buy me a sandwich. Absolutely.
Buy me a sandwich, please. I'm still on my island. My hair is probably a bit damp and smells a bit of rats, but hey ho, I've had my swim. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Thank you so much to my guests, Rob Delaney and Dr. Kate Lister, for such open and funny and thoughtful conversations. Thank you to my producer, Rich Jarman, himself something of an amateur barber. And most of all, thank you to you for listening all the way to the end. Next week's guest is the journalist and one of my favourite tall women, Kat Brown, who will be talking movingly and brilliantly about infertility, mental health, and how it feels to not get pregnant. Please come back next Friday for that. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, and actually even if you haven't, please subscribe and leave me a glowing 5-star review so more people can find it.
honestly, please just do this because it would be wicked. It makes a massive difference. It feels great. And like sun on a cold day, it's completely free.
This is a brand new audio production.